so we'll just call them inductions.
They'll live.
I'm so much doctor, but anyway, it was.
The Health and Human Services Budget Division will come to order. We're continuing our base budget review of the Department of Health, and looks like we're starting with environmental health today.
Madam Chair, Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health, and we are going to continue today. And first up today will be John Stein, the Director of Environmental Health Division. And we are going to continue to walk through this handout that you got yesterday. And if you turn to page 11, this is the Environmental Health Division. And this division gives out very few dollars in grant dollars. The majority of their funding remains at the department for department activity. A lot of the work in this department is regulatory related, and John will tell you more about that. Funding sources are primarily federal funds and fee revenues, with a small portion of general funding supporting broad-based activity.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
My name is John Stein. I'm the Division Director for Environmental Health, Minnesota Health Department. And I'd like to give you a brief overview of our division. As Margaret Kelly mentioned, our primary activity is compliance related. And I'll walk through the handout that was provided to the committee in terms of our programmatic areas and describe what we use the funds that are appropriated to accomplish. Our drinking water program is largely the administration of the Safe Drinking Water Act compliance in Minnesota. The Environmental Protection Agency is the federal agency responsible for implementation of the National Safe Drinking Water Act, and Minnesota has primacy in this program area as provided through that legislation. What we do is administer a series of programmatic activities to assure compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act by collecting samples, drinking water samples from community and non-community water systems across the state. There are approximately 8,000 drinking water systems that we regularly assess by collecting samples, and we gather approximately 150,000 samples per year for community and non-community water systems. The community water system is essentially a public drinking water system that we would all think of that comes to your residential and urban areas of the state. Developed communities have what's called community water systems. Non-community water systems are those systems that are large providers or sources of drinking water in businesses, churches, mobile home, manufactured housing parks, other establishments where large numbers of people get drinking water on a daily basis, churches, schools, et cetera. As I mentioned, we gather 150,000 samples annually, and we have a 96% compliance rate in the state in terms of drinking water meeting federal standards. Those that do not meet federal standards, we work with to bring them toward compliance. Often that's because of the source of the water having some contaminant in it that can be treated or can be alleviated through other means, engineering means, to address any contamination. But a 96% compliance rate is significant, is a significant achievement. Move on to our private well management program, which is the next line on the handout. That is an activity whereby we license contractors in the state that install water wells and borings, and we see about 12,000 water wells constructed every year in Minnesota. Approximately 10,000 abandoned or unused wells are sealed every year, and Minnesota leads the nation with respect to abandonment and proper sealing of old unused wells. Those unused wells provide a conduit for contamination of groundwater through an open hole to deeper aquifers. And so Minnesota has successfully sealed over 200,000 of those wells through the 1989 Groundwater Act provisions that require upon transfer of property title that unused wells be identified and, if unused, properly abandoned. That activity is fee-based. Water well contractors charge fees, pass on those costs to their clients as they construct water wells, and the program is 100% fee supported, as is our drinking water program. I'd like to move on to food safety and hospitality services. This is a program in which we license and inspect restaurant facilities, lodging facilities, recreational campgrounds, and other facilities, including manufactured housing parks. We also inspect and approve plans for public swimming pools through this program. Again, this is a program that is supported by fees. A small amount of the program is supported by the general fund, but the vast majority of our program activities are funded through licensing fees and other fees associated with the program. I'd like to move on to our indoor environments and radiation control work. Again, this is a compliance-related work. For indoor air, we are the administrative authority for the Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act. We also work with schools and other facilities around the state to alleviate or address indoor environment and air quality issues. We do some work out of the general fund on lead hazards here, a couple of small grants that we provide for cleanup, remediation of identified lead problems, largely in older homes where lead paint is an issue and lead-based dust can be a concern for human health. We also provide a small grant for temporary housing facilities for families that need to move out of homes while their property is being remediated. Then moving on to our asbestos abatement program. Again, we license contractors that do this sort of work that go into older buildings and do asbestos abatement. Again, asbestos is an environmental hazard. It can cause damage to human health through your lungs, and the contractors are required to be licensed, that they've received training and are qualified to do the work. We also then oversee the construction of 2,000 sites per year where remediation is going on in properties around the state, and we inspect a certain number of those facilities.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question at that point right there?
Sure.
Thank you. On the asbestos, is there grants available for, if you have a building has asbestos in it, is there grants available to help clean that up? It's funny you should talk about this, because I just had a call from one of my constituents from Buckman, Minnesota, and it's an old school building, and they want to tear it down, but it has asbestos in there. And I'm wondering, is there any grant money available for something like that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Coring, I'm not sure if there are. Linda, she's shaking her head. My expert over here is telling me no, there are not.
Okay, so there's not?
No.
Okay.
Senator Coring, I do believe that it depends on what they're going to tear it down for, but through the Department of Economic Development, there have been grants given out for removal of problem properties in order to make the land available for development.
Thank you. Our radiation control work is a activity that's funded through fees. Through that program, we inspect and certify radiation equipment, x-rays, x-ray tubes, and x-ray equipment in hospitals, clinics, doctor's offices, veterinarians, and dental offices around the state. So we have staff that inspect and certify compliance with the safe operation of that radiation equipment across the state. There's approximately 4,000 facilities that we inspect, and we're on a four-year inspection cycle for that program. Next activity is actually a separate activity, environmental impacts and risk assessment. That's a activity that is funded through the general fund in our division. In that program area, we assess the impacts of environmental contaminants and advise numerous other state and local government agencies. And particularly, we work very closely with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to address emerging environmental threats, such things as asbestos fibers that are found in the environment, other sources of contaminants, where our risk assessment staff assist these other state agencies in developing levels of concern and health-based values for certain contaminants in the environment. We look at numerous sites every year. This is all also the program area where we develop health-based numbers for our safe drinking water program staff that need that information, as well as air quality information that is required for other state agencies. Lastly, we've got amount of general fund for our director's office, and that pretty much concludes the overview of our program activities. One of the things I'll mention is the division is present in all district offices the Minnesota Department of Health has across the state. We house numerous of our drinking water protection staff, our well management staff, and our food safety and hospitality services staff in outstate offices to make their work more efficient. We do delegate some of our program activities to local units of government. In our well management program, we have 9 counties that are delegated to implement the responsibilities for well construction and well abandonment in the state. We also have about 45 communities that operate delegated programs for food safety and hospitality across the state. With that, Madam Chair, I'd answer any questions there are.
Could you just tell me what is the difference between the lead hazard grants and the lead-based grants?
The lead hazard grant is a grant that we give out to do remediation. They're called swab teams. These are folks that go out and when a high lead hazard is found in a property, our folks, our grants go out to help clean up those properties. Thank you. The money was once appropriated to the Department of Education for those activities. The other thing that we use you asked about the lead-based grants.
Mm-hmm.
That's a grant that goes out to an agency that administers temporary housing grants for families that need temporary relocation during remediation of a lead-based problem in their home.
Okay, thank you. Other questions? Senator Olson?
In recent local meetings, I've heard a number of people say that it's now been proven that individual on-site septic systems, if they're properly functioning, are actually more environmentally friendly than large wastewater treatment facilities. And I don't know whether that was just the opinion of a couple of individuals or if the Department of Health has a position on that. Could you, without going into a long explanation, just let me know if the Department of Health has taken a position on that issue?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, we don't have a position on that issue. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is the agency responsible for individual sewage treatment system administration in the state. So we would work with them if there's ever a concern where they needed additional health-based information from the department, but that's really the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency's responsibility.
Other questions? Senator Laurie?
Yes, Madam Chair and Mr. Stein, thank you. I'm wondering about the asbestos abatement program again and how happy you are with its implementation statewide. I mean, I have personally been peripherally involved in 2 projects where I had to do asbestos abatement, and we, went through a licensed contractor and whatnot. This was a few years ago now. But I mean, quite frankly, it was shameful what was happening. I mean, it was an 18-year-old kid who was getting paid by his employer, you know, who was the licensed contractor, like $8 an hour, and he was taking very few precautions, you know, walking out for smoke breaks in between. His mask was hanging off. I mean, and I'm just going, what's happening? And I talked to some of the local building officials in my area, very rural Minnesota, and I don't know, maybe there's a compliance problem as you get out state. I'm just wanting to find out more about that, and hopefully it's come along since the experiences I witnessed.
Madam Chair and Senator Lurie, I'll discuss with the staff your concerns, but let me just say a little bit about what the program is required, what we require of contractors. We require contractors to be licensed through the state. We require them to maintain individual certification for all of their employees, and they have to have some level of education and ongoing education in the program and remediating asbestos in buildings. That being said, there are always challenges with individuals and individual contractors, but I'm not sure whether over the past 5 years we feel compliance is improving or staying the same. I'll go back with the staff and talk about that and get you some additional information so we can answer your question. We do check a certain percentage of the construction sites every year to verify that the work is being done in a fashion that's consistent with the requirements and the guidelines for the contractors. And I'll ask the staff to update me on that.
Thank you.
Other questions? If not, why don't we proceed?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, the next division we'll walk through is on page 13 of your handout, Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control. And Pat Blumgren is coming to the table to walk you through the details of this program. Again, this division is primarily funded with federal funds. 75% of their budget is federal funds, and we will talk about the general fund piece and the fee revenues. The majority of their program is for activities based at the health department, but 19% of their budget does go out the door in grants, primarily in HIV and AIDS area.
And immunizations.
And immunizations, thank you.
Thank you, Margaret. Madam Chair, members, and staff, nice to see some of the faces that were here in the past. There sure are a lot of new ones of you this year. Mm-hmm. The Infectious Disease Division is focused on the prevention and treatment of diseases that are going to make you sick very quickly. You heard yesterday from Mary Manning about chronic diseases where an exposure to some insult to your body makes you sick many years down the road. Well, we have the rewarding pleasure in infectious disease of knowing people that are sick very quickly. This year, in fact, we've had more than twice as many outbreaks of infectious disease reported to us as any other previous year. And in fact, if you've visited any nursing homes, I'm sure you've seen some signs on the door saying, "Do not visit, we are sick." Norovirus has been a migrating threat around the state. Interestingly, the seasonal flu has hardly made an appearance. So I guess we've traded off flu for some other bugs. The money we have in the division and general fund is very important money to us because it forms the core of our technical expertise. We are divided into three divisions, HIV and STDs, sexually transmitted diseases. That's a group of people who work through community-based organizations and through Hennepin and Ramsey County to focus on the reduction and treatment of HIV. We've been fairly successful for about 10 years in keeping the incidence rate flat. We see some indications that the incident rate is growing, and that is partially because the incidence includes the number of people who are living with AIDS much longer than they used to. So the number of AIDS people and HIV positive is increasing slowly, But we're not confident yet that that isn't just an artifact of the fact that people are living longer, which is good news. Another of our sections, immunization, TB, and international health, manages the state role in tuberculosis and screening for health conditions in new refugee arrivals. We do that work primarily through with the assistance of our local public health partners who actually deal with the clients in the field to get them screened when they get here, to get people who are notified that they have TB on medication, and to track them and keep that medication going. We find that when refugees come here, they have many, many things on their mind. And sometimes the keeping a track of their medication and making sure they take it isn't high on their list when they're trying to get their family in shelter and make sure they have food and clothing. So we count on local public health to do that kind of legwork to help our newly arrived citizens and our folks that get TB on without, they aren't refugees, but just TB when it's transmitted in its habitat. So we put a focus on both of those areas and have significant grants in immunization and TB and refugee health. Our immunization program is one of the better ones in the country in that we have some of the highest immunization rates for children's immunizations of any state in the country. And before you can ask, we are studying the human papillomavirus vaccine issue, and I think probably in a couple years we may be coming forward with a request for a policy direction and funding on that one. But we won't be prepared to do that this year, although I suspect you're going to get some pressure from people who think we should get started on that. We just aren't ready. In the acute disease and infection control group, we have the core of our technical support of some highly technical staff who are specialized in infection control, for example, foodborne disease, vector-borne disease, and a lot of the technical work that supports work in other sections is initiated in the ADIC section, including a lot of the technical work for pandemic flu that I assume we'll be talking about later on in the session, where we are on that. For our general fund budget, we have $601,000 in the director's office, which pays for 6.5 FTE, including the director, the assistant division director, and office support, and some of our web services and IT support. We also have a one-time appropriation for pan-flu activities of $100,000. That funds one of our field epidemiologists. The budget 5601 in immunization, TB, and international health funds the manager of that section, who is responsible for managing approximately 60 staff in the division. The TB, org 5609 has $460,000 in it for TB medications, of which we distribute in two separate ways. One, we have a partnership with Boynton at the University of Minnesota, and they act as our pharmacists statewide. So they distribute our TB meds statewide for us. We also have a $160,000 contract with Hennepin County because, frankly, they have over half the cases of TB and they need some additional help staffing the case management workload. We find this particularly useful to use Boynton because it's substantially reduced our costs and makes for a more efficient operation since they're already in the business. We use a multi-state contract to purchase the medicines, so it is quite a savings in costs. That funding also pays for the TB program manager. The general fund operating dollars in 5642, eliminating health disparities, and refugee health and tuberculosis are for two half FTEs, which coordinate refugee health screenings and TB medication description. And the next org has the eliminating health disparities and refugee health.
Did you move to a new page here on us?
What?
Are you on a different page now?
Oh, yes. You got the new one. Now I did too. The immunization, they have a section manager, they buy TB meds, and they manage refugee health and TB, and they have grants to for refugee health and TB to local public health. Acute disease investigation has section management, infection control, and all that technical support that I mentioned earlier, and is the site of food safety. Food safety is the epidemiological half of the work that is done in environmental health on the inspection process for food establishments. We work in partnership with environmental health, and, of course, both of us use the laboratory, our public health laboratory, to identify the stool samples. STD and HIV has section management and granting. And we do have the two one-time appropriations for pandemic flu.
Madam Chair, given one appropriation of $5 million. We just can't find where it is in here.
Madam Chair, when we get to the Office of Emergency Preparedness, where all those dollars primarily went, we do have a one-page handout that will walk you through where all $5 million ended up within the department. Much of it went to the Department of Public Safety. Much of it stayed within the Office of Emergency Preparedness, and a small piece is being managed by Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control for a public education campaign, the $500,000, and some epidemiological work.
Well, we'll be anxious to see that handout, but it does seem to me that it should show up on these base budget pages also.
Madam Chair, the budget system managed by the Department of Finance reports out on where dollars were expended as opposed to where dollars were appropriated, and that's why you're seeing it over here, because the dollars were spent in this division.
Okay.
I apologize for confusing you, Madam Chair, with the old printout.
Are there any other questions on this page? Senator Coring?
Madam Chair, is it Blumgren?
Blumgren,
thank you. On the HIV, you were saying that the number of cases are not flat anymore, they're going up.
Madam Chair, Senator Corning, yes, we are seeing a small increase. We'll need another year or so to see if what that relates to.
Madam Chair, do you...
Senator Coring.
Ms. Blumgren, do you think that as time goes by and these young people that are 18, 19, 20, they don't understand how... I can remember, in the 80s and 90s how, people really focusing on HIV infection. And now it seems like we've just kind of like forgotten about it. And as the new generation has come along, they don't realize the danger that's out there. And do you think that we in government are doing all we can to make these kids aware of the dangers of HIV?
Madam Chair, Senator, we are doing the best we can within available resources. We have 18 contracts with groups who are into AIDS prevention. They carry the message for us. We do know from our epidemiological data that the young people are in need of further education, that late teens, early 20s, especially African-American males, And we're working. We have a small campaign, education campaign. I doubt that you'll see any of it because it's posted in some restrooms of facilities where they frequent in the club scene. And you may have seen or will see a sideboard on the LR, the light rail, about STDs. And, you know, when someone's got STDs, you start worrying about HIV. And when someone has HIV and comes in with STDs, then you know they're not practicing safe sex. Mm-hmm. So we're catching a lot of them that way and trying to educate them. But it is a problem. We have black African Americans are the ones we focus most grants on this year. The next set of grants will probably look at the Hispanic culture, because what we find with Hispanics is that they don't go to the doctor soon enough, so that it doesn't get caught at the HIV level. They come in only after they've reached full-blown AIDS. Okay.
And,
yes.
And then, Madam Chair, one other question. Does the health... There are. I know that there's some places where you can go and have an anonymous test, and I think it's called the Red Door Clinic. Correct. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, there are two places in the Twin Cities: the Red Door Clinic in Hennepin County, which they run with some money from us, and Room 111 in Ramsey, just down the street, actually, which they also run for us.
And then, let's say that's done anonymously. If somebody comes in and they're positive, do you have those numbers? Do you get those numbers from that clinic so that you know of what's happening out there in the real world?
Yes, we do. And if a positive person agrees, then we can get the information to visit them. But there's no obligation at the first step on that. But usually they get referred from the clinic to a healthcare provider, and healthcare providers are very good about notifying us. And then we follow up with visits, counseling, treatment, all kinds of services for the people that we are notified have been diagnosed.
Okay. Thank you.
I noticed that in this particular area you've got 6.3 FTEs, and they're all listed as section management. Are they all managers?
No, ma'am. They are in the director's office, and there's a receptionist, there's my secretary, there's a web-based manager, which is not a manager of people, it's a manager of our web information. There's a technical IT type. Did I say receptionist? Anyway, that's the type of employees they are. They're not managers. They're in the management office.
Okay, well, maybe you could give us a little better breakdown then, so, because that's not how it's listed on here.
Madam Chair?
Questions? Yes, Senator Sharon.
I have a couple of questions. One is, has there been a change or a shift in funding or money away from this particular area of your budget to go to some other need that might contribute to a change in the pattern that we're seeing in terms of the incidence of AIDS? And the second is, what is being done if, short of waiting till somebody goes in to see their physician, to get information about safe sexual practices to persons who have different cultural attitudes, approaches, or languages, so that we're able to get information early and get into a prevention cycle rather than a reactive cycle?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, we do have several of our grantees working to get the information out for prevention. And I think I could probably get a short synopsis of each of those grant programs. If you would like me to, I could send that up.
Has money been shifted away from HIV education and prevention programming to some in the recent years? Has your budget in this area decreased?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, our budget has decreased. Not that it was shifted away to something at the state level. It's just that we don't always get our total costs. So we've had to take small reductions at the state level. The bigger reductions, however, are in the federal funds. We've taken a rescission last year where they came in and actually took money we already were spending, and we're hearing that we're going to get another 10% cut this year. And I guess it just reflects the federal priorities as they exist at this time. There just isn't enough money to go around.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Okay, then let's move on.
Madam Chair, next up is our public health laboratory, and Norm Crouch, Assistant Commissioner, is going to talk first about how our laboratory works and interacts with all divisions at the Department of Health, and then Chris Everson will walk through the detailed budget. It begins on page 15. The lab is funded with a combination of federal funds, state-appropriated general funds, appropriated fee revenues, and contracts that we have with other labs or with other agencies or within the department. And all of the funding stays with the lab for laboratory activity. There are no grants.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Norm Crouch, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Health Protection for the Minnesota Department of Health. Here with me is Chris Everson, the laboratory's acting director, and she'll be giving you an overview of the laboratory division and its budget. But before she does, as indicated by Margaret, I'd like to take a few minutes to describe our new laboratory facility and to extend an invitation for all of you to come over for a tour. I think Commissioner Mandernach also extended that to you yesterday. We think you'll find it an interesting place, and you'll see firsthand how this new state-of-the-art laboratory supports public health-related programs statewide. It has broad analytical capability using sophisticated technologies, and it works with many partners, including our MDH programs, other state agencies, local public health, the private sector, and the medical community. The laboratory's activities involve infectious diseases, environmental health, newborn screening, laboratory certification, and emergency response. The laboratory also serves Minnesota as part of the National Laboratory Response Network, which includes being one of only 10 Level 1 chemical terrorism preparedness laboratories in the nation. In addition, it serves as a collaborating laboratory for influenza surveillance for the CDC in collaboration and connection with the World Health Organization. Because of the nature of the work done in this laboratory, a major feature of our new facility is safety and security. This is especially important because the laboratory analyzes a wide variety of samples and specimens that may contain infectious agents, hazardous chemicals, or radioactive materials. All of the work done with potentially dangerous infectious agents is carried out using protective biosafety cabinets located within strict biocontainment areas referred to as biosafety level 3 or BSL-3 areas. Within these BSL-3 areas, all of the exhaust air is passed through special biological filters to remove any infectious agents that might be present before it leaves the top of the building. All of the work with hazardous chemicals is done using special chemical fume hoods designed to protect the workers and the internal and external environments. In addition to these regular BSL-3 containment areas located within three different parts of the laboratory, there are also two other areas designed to achieve even greater levels of biosafety and containment. This includes a BSL-3 enhanced laboratory suite to work with agents such as avian influenza virus, and a BSL-4, this is level 4 now, glove box in which to safely open and examine suspicious packages that may contain dangerous, unknown, infectious, toxic, or radioactive materials brought to the laboratory by emergency responders, including the FBI, in the face of a known or suspected emergency. Because of its design, equipment, and trained personnel, this new facility serves Minnesota well. It is truly an asset to our state in its role to protect the public's health. I thank you for the opportunity to say a few words on behalf of the laboratory and its new facilities. And if you have any questions, I would be happy to try to answer them.
Are there any questions? We are still working on getting a time to come and visit the lab, so maybe we'll see you again soon.
Madam Chair?
Oh, my staff says it's scheduled for Friday, February 2nd.
Okay, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Everson. I'm the acting director of the Public Health Laboratory Division. I'd like to walk your committee through our activities funded with the general fund and SGSR dollars. Our division is provides scientific expertise and data used by public health partners for critical public health threat intervention and policy decisions. And the foundation of all of our activities is our scientific capability, the quality of our analyses, and the many partnerships we have built with public, private, and program partners. Our division is organized in sections, including division management, our clinical laboratory, environmental laboratory, and laboratory services. I'd like to first describe some of the activities that are funded with, in part with general fund in our environmental laboratory. Environmental monitoring near Minnesota's nuclear power plants. We analyze environmental samples such as soil, milk, water, and vegetation from the surrounding areas of the nuclear power plants in Minnesota. Our environmental laboratory participates as a member of the Minnesota's radiological response team and maintains preparedness to receive samples 24/7. We also respond to public health threats from chemical exposures by providing 24/7 analytical capability and scientific expertise. We respond to environmental emergencies, including environmental accidents, natural or man-made disasters, including suspected terrorism events. And our laboratory is a member of the chemical component of the National Laboratory Response Network, along with 62 state territorial laboratories. As Dr. Crouch mentioned, our laboratory has the distinction of being a level one laboratory, which means we are not only able to identify chemical agents, but we also have the capability to detect exposure to an expanded number of chemicals, including mustard agents, nerve agents, and other toxic industrial chemicals. Next, our clinical laboratory analyzes approximately 56,000 clinical specimens per year for infectious bacteria, viruses, fungi, and parasites. The clinical laboratory has four major responsibilities: monitoring for public health threats. We conduct statewide monitoring for emergence of public health threats. This testing enables us to detect disease outbreaks as well as other public health threats posed by newly infectious agents. For example, we continuously monitor the circulating influenza strains. So we're always looking for major changes in the virus that might signal a pandemic strain. We also do susceptibility testing to detect trends in drug resistance. This is important because our findings can impact policy and treatment decisions. We collaborate with the Minnesota Department of Health acute epidemiology programs to identify trends such as the emergence of new diseases as well as the reemergence of diseases such as tuberculosis. For example, we conduct diagnostic testing for TB and perform drug susceptibility testing on isolates from all TB cases in Minnesota. This is important because this information is used by healthcare providers to make treatment decisions, and it also provides data to the Minnesota Department of Health's prevention and control programs to guide their activities. Our clinical lab also does another major responsibility is disease outbreak investigation and control. And again, by working with the acute disease epidemiologist and analyzing human specimens, we are able to detect disease outbreaks, focus a disease outbreak investigation, and plan an effective public health intervention. A more recent example of this activity is the recent foodborne outbreak at Taco John's. Our laboratory analyzed specimens and were able to provide data to link cases both in Minnesota and outside of Minnesota through DNA fingerprinting. Another very important part of our clinical laboratory is the reference testing. Our clinical lab provides reference and confirmatory testing of specimens in collaboration with hospitals, clinics, and other clinical labs in the state. We have expertise not available in most labs, and these laboratories in the state send us isolates of bacteria or viruses that they believe are important and need to be identified. There are many benefits to this partnership. It effectively extends and increases the testing capability of Minnesota hospitals and clinics and clinical labs. And it is this activity that will likely discover a pandemic strain of influenza or unrecognized smallpox. Our clinical lab and environmental lab, as I mentioned earlier, are very much involved in emergency preparedness and response. Our clinical lab is a member of the biological component of the National Laboratory Response Network. We receive samples from hospital emergency rooms, clinics, schools, mailing facilities, first responders, and law enforcement agencies. We work closely with local public health, the State Patrol, Minnesota Department of Homeland Security, National Guard, Centers for Disease Control Prevention, FBI, and others to maintain preparedness. We also maintain a statewide voluntary network of laboratories to facilitate inter-laboratory communication, collaboration, and cooperation. Called the Minnesota Laboratory System, it's based on electronic connectivity and is used as an essential tool for emergency preparedness and response. Now, our SGSR-funded activities include the Newborn Screening Program and the Environmental Lab Certification Program. Our laboratory screens all newborns shortly after birth for 53 rare heritable and congenital medical conditions. Each year, our newborn screening program screens approximately 72,000 babies born in Minnesota and saves lives or greatly improves the quality of life for approximately 100 children each year. The program is funded by a fee assessed to the hospitals for each newborn screen. This covers both the laboratory screening activities as well as short-term follow-up activities. The newborn screening system includes hospitals, nursery staff, laboratory scientists, couriers, specialists, pediatricians, primary care providers, geneticists, and staff who connect families with needed resources. In 2006, our newborn screening program began screening newborns for cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is a genetic disease that commonly affects breathing and digestion. While there's no cure for CF, advances in CF treatment continue to have a great impact on the length and quality of life for babies with CF. The success of our newborn screening program is in part due to our strong public-private partnerships. We partner with the University of Minnesota to assure that babies are immediately connected with specialty care. And we partner with the Mayo Clinic's Biomedical Genetics Laboratory to screen newborns using advanced technology called tandem mass spectrometry, also known as TMS. TMS makes it possible to screen for multiple conditions using a single test. We also have strong program partners. We partner with the department's Family Health Division, who works with families to assure affected babies are immediately connected with specialty care and needed resources. This is very important because treatment may require multiple services that are often provided by a patchwork of agencies, both public and private, and some resources may not be available locally for management of these rare disorders. The Environmental Laboratory Certification is also funded with fees. Our certification program certifies approximately 170 public and private environmental laboratories to perform testing for federal programs that require laboratory certification. It's supported entirely by a biennial fee paid by the laboratories who request certification. In Minnesota, these federal programs are administered by the Environmental Health Division of the Minnesota Department of Health and the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. The Environmental Laboratory Certification Program is voluntary in Minnesota. Finally, our laboratory specimen handling fee supports a small amount of staff, 1.7 FTEs, to support specimen and sample receiving in the department. That concludes my presentation. If there are any questions, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions? If not, thank you. We'll move on then.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Everson, could you explain once again the new board's greeting process, who pays for that?
The fee is assessed to the hospitals, who usually, of course, charge the insurance companies that cover the families.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. How does Minnesota rank in our newborn screening, even in our prenatal screening? Do we do any prenatal screening?
Madam Chair, the prenatal screening's outside of my area of knowledge and responsibility, so I can't really respond to that. But in terms of the newborn screening program, Minnesota is very highly regarded in the nation as being a leader and at the forefront of newborn screening. Our partnership with the Mayo Clinic, for example, is used as an example in other states, as well as our follow-up activities and the strength of our partnerships.
The laboratory is shared with the Department of Agriculture.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And how many FTEs do they have working in the lab?
Madam Chair, I'm not exactly sure of the number, but it's generally about a 60% a 60% health and 40% agriculture. And in the health laboratory, we have about 140 FTEs.
Any other questions? Senator Sharon?
Chair, thank you. Director Everson, what is the fee for this screening? What is it that the department charges?
Madam Chair, the current fee is $61 per infant, but we are requesting an increase in the fee this year. It was last raised 4 years ago.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen?
Sorry. Ms. Everson, is there a consent form that needs to be signed by the mother or the family of the child for the screening?
Madam Chair, parents are provided the opportunity to opt out of the screening, and the hospitals, birthing hospitals, have a responsibility to inform parents of that option. They also have the option of having the blood spots that are collected and analyzed destroyed. So they have, and that those those opportunities are to be explained by the hospital staff to the parents.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
When there is a new test added on, of course, I would assume that adds on to the cost, or is it just incrementally raised every year? I mean, how does the cost work?
Madam Chair, we are on a sort of a system of, we have in the last several years of raising the fee every 4 years, which means we put a budget together that should support newborn screening activities for a four-year period. So the last time we came in front of you, it was 4 years ago. That's not to say that in 2 years, if the advances in newborn screening have been dramatic and that we would recommend adding additional disorders that might raise costs, that we wouldn't come back in 2 years, but we plan on a budget on a four-year cycle. Does that answer your question?
Madam Chair, one more question.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Do you screen for any recreational drugs or any type of drugs besides diseases?
Madam Chair, no, we do not.
Okay.
Any other questions? If not, thank you. Let's move on then.
Madam Chair, members, next up is our Office of Emergency Preparedness, which has in the past been funded, on page 17 of your handout, has in the past been funded 100% with federal funds. Last legislative session, an appropriation from the general fund was made to the Department of Health for pandemic influenza preparedness, a $5 million appropriation. We have a handout here that we can pass out that explains how those funds were used. We worked closely with the Department of Public Safety in deciding how to use those funds. We had come forward with a $10 million appropriate request, and we worked closely with the Department of Public Safety to allocate the funds, and under authority and statute for state agencies to work together, we contracted with the Department of Public Safety to carry out some of the functions that we had identified in the original budget request. And Jane Braun, Assistant Director of the Office of Emergency Preparedness, is here to talk to you more about what that office does and to walk through the detail of the pandemic influenza funding.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, as Margaret said, I'm Jane Braun. I'm Assistant Director of the Office of Emergency Preparedness. And because the office is a relatively new part of the Department of Health, I'll do a brief history. Prior to the fall of 2001, response to emergencies by the Minnesota Department of Health was the responsibility of each individual program. And with the attacks of 9/11 and the anthrax events in October of 2001, the federal government developed a federally driven process to improve and strengthen the public health and the healthcare programs. And in the spring of 2002, the Office of Emergency Preparedness was created to coordinate the activities of the Minnesota Department of Health in working with local public health, the healthcare system, emergency managers, and other emergency response partners. The office is the coordinating entity for the CDC and the HRSA grants, which account for approximately $24 million in the current grant year. Some of our activity focuses on working with federal government, particularly CDC and HRSA, as they develop the strategies, set the areas of priority, changes in direction, requests for information, and performance measurement efforts. And while the two federal grants are supposed to be complementary, their parent agencies don't always talk to each other all the time, and we're coping with competing federal priorities sometimes. Both grants are formula-driven and are based primarily on population. The Office of Emergency Preparedness has six main areas of focus: the Strategic National Stockpile and the City's Readiness Initiative, planning, education, and exercises, administration and legal, partner alerting and communication, healthcare system preparedness, and coordination with local public health and tribal governments. And I'll just cover each of these six areas briefly. The Strategic National Stockpile is a program for rapidly distributing supplies, equipment, and medications, which can be requested if we have a large event and our existing resources are overwhelmed. It's a large cache that would fill 12 trucks and can be flown to anywhere in the country within 12 hours if needed. The stockpile was used in New York after 9/11 and on the Gulf Coast after the 2005 hurricanes. We're required to have just-in-time warehouses to receive the material, the ability to break down the supplies, transportation and security system to move the materials across the state, and the ability to track where the supplies are sent and how they're used. A special project that's part of the SNS is called the City's Readiness Initiative, which focuses on getting oral medications to every resident in the 11-county metro area within 48 hours. And this program relies on several creative strategies, including working with private businesses and the U.S. Postal Service. Finally, we manage and storage and distribution plans for chemical antidotes for first responders exposed to certain terrorism agents and medications for certain infectious agent exposures. This planning would not be possible without the considerable involvement and support of hospitals and local public health agencies across the state. Second area is the planning, education, and exercises. Responding to public health emergencies requires a great deal of upfront planning, and the Minnesota Department of Health is assigned responsibilities by the federal government and by the state or the Minnesota Emergency Operations Plan. We've developed a health all-hazard plan that provides the foundation for a response to any type of emergency, regardless of the cause. This plan changes to address the specifics of an event, whether it's a weather-related disaster, such as a flood or an ice storm, or an infectious disease outbreak. And we are required to have response staff trained in the national response system so that everyone has similar skills and approaches to an event. This is intended to reduce confusion from using the same terms to mean different things or responding in conflicting ways. For example, in an emergency, if you ask for a squad, a military person will send you 8 to 12 soldiers. An EMS person will send you an ambulance with one or two paramedics. And public safety will send you a police car with one or two officers. So we have to have consistent terminology to get an appropriate response. And we also assist local public health and the healthcare system in planning and delivering training. And we are currently launching a web-based system that tracks available training and also the courses that have been completed by individual staff. Finally, a plan is only as good as the ability to carry it out. 2007 starts a 3-year comprehensive exercise plan to test our procedures, communications, actions, and assumptions. We're working with many partners on exercising, and you're likely to see or hear about exercises in your local communities, and I would encourage you to take advantage of those events to learn more about what is in place and what the expectations are of elected officials in an emergency. Exercises provide information on what works well and also what needs to be improved. We follow the national process and the timelines for tracking issues and following up on the recommended changes. Third area would be the administration and legal, and this area focuses on grant applications, budget management, progress reports, coordinating activities with the federal agencies, and reaching out to the border states and provinces. And this has been particularly important with pandemic influenza, as planning for this event is expected to affect all areas of the country at the same time. Many of you may remember that we have modified state law to be more responsive to the types of issues that terrorism or infectious disease outbreaks may cause. Our fourth area is partner alerting and communications. In any type of emergency, communication is the foundation of a good response. We have a number of tools already in use and also under development. A primary tool for reaching out to our partners is something called the Health Alert Network. This is a robust method of emailing information throughout the state. It also has a connected system that can send automated phone calls to pre-designated 24/7 phone numbers. This system currently has approximately 3,000 users, and then there also are lists available. For example, with the E. coli with the spinach last fall, we were able to send phone calls to 16,000 restaurants to alert them about the need to stop serving fresh spinach. We also have a secure website for sharing sensitive information, such as emergency response plans, locations of equipment, or home cell phone numbers of response staff. We also are working with the Department of Public Safety on communication issues during an event, so we can talk with our partners and make sure that everyone has the most up-to-date information possible. The healthcare system preparedness area is next, and working closely to prepare emergency response plans and systems with the hospitals and other parts of the healthcare system is a new area of focus for the Minnesota Department of Health. We now manage a grant program for the 8 regions of the state. Each region has identified coordinating hospitals and regional staff to work on issues such as decontamination, medical supplies, treatment protocols, and preparing to care for a large number of patients. In the fall of 2005, we worked with others to prepare Camp Ripley, which was known as Operation Northern Comfort, to receive as many as 3,000 potentially injured and certainly traumatized persons from the Gulf region. And with the support of the National Guard, we were able to have that facility ready in 2 days. And while no storm survivors came to the camp, it was a great learning experience for all of us in understanding how to put plans into action. And the federal government has asked that each hospital develop plans to particularly address 4 types of events in this coming year. Those events are pandemic influenza, an explosion, an ice storm, and an anthrax exposure. And each hospital will exercise their plans to identify areas that are working well and others that need attention. And Minnesota was the first wave of states to develop healthcare worker volunteer programs. We currently have approximately 3,000 health professionals who are part of the Minnesota Response Program who have said we can call on them for an event somewhere in Minnesota, and some are even willing to go to other parts of the country to respond to a health event. The final area would be coordination with local public health and with tribal governments. And there's a saying in public health and emergency management that all disasters are local. And we've certainly had many examples of that in these past few years. Local public health and tribal governments have done tremendous work recently in leading their communities in developing plans to address health issues that arise from any type of disaster. Using the federal requirements, we develop a formula for funding local activities that provides a base level of funding and increases as the population of the jurisdiction increases. We develop grant duties such as requiring the development of a local all-hazards plan, an exercise requirement, communication expectation, and then other duties that support preparedness and response. We've been very impressed with the local involvement and the participation of the tribal governments in the work of increasing Minnesota's preparedness. Final area I'll cover is the pandemic influenza planning. Last year, as you recall, the legislature authorized $5 million for fiscal year 2007 for pandemic influenza preparedness activities. And to make the best use of this one-time money, purchases and activities that could most quickly increase the preparedness and response capacity receive priority. And the funds are being used to, as you see on your handout, primarily to purchase antiviral medications at a significant discount through the federal program, to purchase about 200 respiratory ventilators, and to support staff and related expenses, to develop a public education campaign, support interagency agreement with the Department of Public Safety for grants and tribal governments, emergency management, staff and related expenses again, and grants to state agencies to prepare plans for assisting their customers and partners. This concludes my overview of the Office of Emergency Preparedness, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions.
The first question that I have is, you received some federal funding last fall for pandemic flu planning as well, and I don't see it on the sheets or the handouts. Did you want to let us know what you're using that money for?
Madam Chair, we did not prepare a summary of federal preparedness dollars, and we can do that for you to describe specifically what the amounts are and how they're used, but if you want more information now.
Well, I think it would be helpful to us to understand how the state money is interacting with the federal money. Mm-hmm. I think at the time you requested the state money, you didn't know the federal money would be coming, and so I thought it would be coming, but the other question that I have is this $500,000 on public education. Has that money been spent?
Madam Chair, the contract with the vendor who is coordinating the campaign has been signed. The vendor has begun work. We haven't actually spent money on buying the spots or that type of thing, but that program is well along. They've met all of their deadlines for getting the money spent by June 30th and for hitting the particular areas that they plan to. So that project is on track.
And so we would still be spending the $500,000 even if there is no pandemic flu outbreak?
Madam Chair, there's, you know, when I talked earlier about the all-hazards response, there basically are some components of this pandemic flu public education campaign that would benefit any disaster. So we feel that it's a very important thing to get this public awareness going. And a lot of the campaign is beyond just putting out checklists or those types of things. It's looking at what will motivate people to actually prepare and what will make a difference. And a lot of those steps will benefit us whether the pandemic occurs 2 months from now or 20 years from now.
People are going to remember what you tell them this year 20 years from now?
Madam Chair, I think that it's getting some concepts across on what types of things a family should do. For example, having a plan in place, having talked about a plan. If the pandemic comes, there would be several weeks' warning, and they'd be able to think about what they had previously done. Granted, any stockpiling certainly needs to be rotated. I'm not saying that that would last.
Madam Chair?
And so this, when are these public education spots going to be aired?
Madam Chair, Pat Blumgren from Infectious Disease. We're the administrators of this contract. And your question is, when are the public information spots going to be aired? The answer is when we have funding to do that. We will have the materials prepared. We will have some. We've already done a survey to see what people know about being prepared at this point, and it's pretty appalling. What they see on TV doesn't seem to be connecting with preparedness at the home level. It's kind of like everybody else is going to get the flu, but not me or my family. And so they're designing spots, which maybe some of them we can do with that could be pretty low budget. But we do not have an implementation of delivery part of this $500. It's the preparation of it, and we're hoping that we will find some funding for that, and that even if we don't, we hope to be able to do kind of black and white versions of what we might have done in color, if I can simplify it that way.
So the $500,000 is not actually buying any media. It's just preparing materials for media use. Holy
man. Madam Chair, that is true.
Madam Chair?
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of questions. One, I'd be interested to know what was the dollar amount of the federal funds that complement this expenditure. And secondly, on your $5 million one-time expenditure, it appears that $1.3 million of that was allocated or directed towards very concrete, specific things, the medication and the ventilators. And so I guess in light of the dollars that were allocated to planning, if you will, and hearing that you're indicating that there aren't apparently funds to fully implement this plan, after this expenditure, how would you rate our state of preparedness as compared to, say, a year ago at this time?
Madam Chair, Senator Lynch, we have just completed analysis of how prepared we are. I didn't bring the material today, but I think that would be a very informative presentation for the committee later on when you get into the pandemic flu topic. And I would offer to the chair that we would be happy to make a short presentation on our preparedness. We are far more prepared today than we were a year ago, even more prepared than we were 2 years ago, and it's a constantly improving process, and some of it is very well done, especially those types of things that rely on our base programs that we already had in operation. Expanding those to include the pandemic flu event is much easier than starting over having to do something for the pandemic flu event. So the fact that the legislature has put money into disease monitoring through the years is really the foundation of much of the good work we've been able to do on pandemic so far. But in terms of working with all the state agencies that are involved and working with local public health and all the local agencies that are involved, without good connections to local public health and good connections through a variety of forms with other state agencies, we would be further behind than we are now.
Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation information. I appreciate your comment earlier about all disasters being local. And to that extent, I would really speak to support the public education campaign that they're talking about preparing, although the delivery of that sounds like it's going to take some additional funding. But when you're looking at this overall plan to roll out resources, whether they're the antiviral medications and the ventilators, we still need a program that deals with public education in order to articulate the whole thing. I went down with the Red Cross as a disaster relief nurse after Katrina, and I was stationed at a facility that had 1,200 evacuees, some double evacuees at it, and it was 4 hours away from New Orleans. And yet, we could have a very well-tuned facility right there dealing with the evacuees and the community around us was not informed and not prepared to deal with that at all, and that was 4 hours away from the site. So I think when you're talking about Fort Ripley being prepared and stocked and everything else, you still need public education, a way to engage the local population and the local resources, and that comes through the public education piece. And that's one thing we lived through. You know, it can be wonderfully organized from the federal level or the state level, but unless the locals are engaged and know what's going on, it doesn't flow.
Any other questions, Senator Pretner Solon?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I think that I would like to see a breakdown of the $500,000 on public education campaign expenditures, because that seems like an awful lot to not have any hard copy or any delivery system available. And I would like to see the backup for that, please.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair, may I just interject? It's not that there isn't a deliverable. It's that our capacity to deliver it in a massive public campaign is very, very limited. We will have the deliverables to us, but it's our ability to deliver on to the public that is limited.
Madam Chair, I still would like to see a breakdown of the expenses.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only question, I kept redoing the math, so it was $1,500 per respirator, ventilator, for and it's, you know, basically the Cadillac instead of the bicycle. You have 200 respirators bought. My first question is, that seems to be an awful lot of money for a respirator. I don't know. And second of all, the federal funds that are coming in, are you going to be allocating some of that for more respirators, or are you going to be coming back to the state for money to buy those needed respirators? Because 200 is clearly just a drop.
Well, we will be getting a breakdown of how they're using the federal funds. We just asked for that. So they aren't prepared with that today. They said they would get it to us. Are there any other questions about the state funds? If not, then let's move on. And we certainly are not going to expect that we will be financing the Department of Public Safety through this division in the future.
Madam Chair, next up is our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, which begins on page 19 of your handout. This office is primarily funded with state general fund dollars. There is also a piece of TANF funds, which are federal dollars, temporary assistance for needy families. The funds flow through the Department of Human Services and come to the Department of Health for eliminating health disparity activities. And there's a small federal grant and contracts with DHS as well. I need to double check this chart, this graph on page 19, because I think it is flipped. The majority of the work of this division is out in the community, and I believe it's an MDH activity that's 11% and not grants that are 11%. But I'll let Mitchell Davis, the director of that office, begin.
Madam Chair and committee, as Margaret has said, my name is Mitchell Davis. I'm the division director for the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. And I want to give an overview of the initiative and also then speak of the expenditures. In 2001, the Minnesota legislature created the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative, and it is a 10-year statewide initiative to address and eliminate racial and ethnic state disparities in Minnesota through local and statewide activities and the community and also tribal health grants. The mission of the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is to support culturally appropriate public health programs designed and implemented by racial and ethnic communities. The success of these programs is built on the community assets and grounded in the cultural beliefs and the practices and the traditions of the communities. This grant is administered through the Minnesota Department of Health, Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. This statewide initiative focuses on Africans, African Americans, American Indians, Asians, Latinos, and tribal nations in 8 health disparity areas. And they are breast and cervical cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, healthy youth development, immunizations, infant mortalities, HIV/AIDS, and unintentional injuries and violence. Now, the grantees, they serve diverse geographic regions. Some of the grantees provide services in multiple counties. We're in approximately 42 counties in Minnesota out of the 87. And the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is innovative. It's one of the first and currently the only existing statewide effort in the nation to focus on health and the well-being of populations of color and American Indians. I'm going to talk just a bit about the innovation and the partnerships. About half of the grantees that have responded, they have named more than one area that they're working in. And they innovatively have worked on curricular instruction, focusing on community strengths and assets, building partnerships, and using participatory approaches in programming. They also focus on the strength of the people in the community so that the staffs are reflective of the community that they serve. The participatory approaches involve community and planning the programs and also the activities. Under the partnerships, this is a very important part of the initiative. And the partnerships refer to the grantees building collaborative relationships with other community groups, public health, local public health, cultural groups, and also the healthcare delivery system. A large majority of the grantees, approximately 93%, have partnerships which variably move across the spectrum: community organizations, healthcare facilities, schools, tribes, and also government agencies. Under the cultural strengths, the grantees build on in the community in many ways. The knowledge and experience of the community members are important resources for the grantees. For example, elders and traditional healers have provided guidance and counsel for grantees working with American Indian community and the African American community. A coalition of women with personal experience with breast and cervical cancer have really helped to develop effective ways to improve the screening for breast and cervical cancer. The Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, we have infant mortality and immunization grants, tribal government grants, the disease area grants, and also director's office. Under the infant mortality and immunization grants, that's within the statute, that is certainly has a target for reduction within the statute. And in the health department narrative for the minority and multicultural health area, I will just note some of the progress to the target areas. The American Indian, our target is 9.5. Our most recent data is showing that we have moved to about 9.9. So we're not there yet, but we're making progress. Originally, we started at 13.5 when this initiative started. Under the Asian and Pacific Islander, the target is 6.3. And these are infant deaths per 1,000. The target is 6.3 deaths in 1,000 for Asian and Pacific Islanders. We're currently at 5.9, so we certainly have made some good progress there.
And where did we start out at?
We started at 7.1. Under the Black African American, we started at 13.2. The target rate is 6.4, and we have made progress at this point to 10.2 per 1,000 deaths. Hispanic, Latino, we started at 7 infant deaths per 1,000. Our target is 6.3. As the most current data, we're at 6.1. So we've made some improvement there as well.
Can these targets that were set, when was the date of achievement supposed to be?
2010.
Okay.
Under the tribal government grants, those are on the reservations, and they work specifically on the reservations and maternal child health, infant mortality, and healthy youth development. The other grant, other areas that we work in, the other six, are breast cancer, cervical cancer, cardiovascular or heart disease, diabetes, healthy youth development, HIV/AIDS, and also violence and unintentional injury. And then the final area is the director's office. We have an office of seven, the director, tribal liaison, four health coordinators that work in each of the respective communities, and also administrative support.
Thank you. As a part of this program, which was started about 5 years ago, I think the first grants went out, there was a component for evaluation. And I'm wondering if the evaluation has been completed.
That evaluation is ongoing. We have moved that to a contractor, a Rainbow Research, and we're in the process of looking at the new data for the second two-year program of this initiative.
So when will that evaluation be available for us to look at?
We can make that available. We're receiving those evaluations over the next several months for the second phase, the second two-year process.
Okay. Questions, Senator Olson?
For those of us who are new to this committee, Madam Chair, and could you give me the infant mortality rate for the general population, just so we know that for comparison?
Madam Chair, Senator, the white population when this started was 5.5 deaths per thousand.
Okay. And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Olson.
Why was the infant mortality target rate set so much higher for the American Indian population, if you know?
Mm-hmm. At 9.5, just clarification.
Yes, it was 9 point something, I think.
9.5.
Follow up and move that information.
Madam Chair, I can try and help out here. The target in statute was a 50% reduction, I believe, in the infant mortality rates. And so at the time we looked at what the rate was within each racial ethnic group, and we said a 50% reduction in that rate would mean that the target rate for that population is 9.9. In the white population, the infant mortality rate is significantly lower. It's significantly higher in the other populations, which is why we have a huge gap in health disparities. And so it's not suggesting that we think a higher rate is acceptable for those populations. It's saying that our target is to reduce the rate by 50%. And because they're starting at a much higher rate, the target rate for those populations is also higher.
But we had another group, I don't know which one, I didn't mark them down, that was starting at 13.2, and the target for that is 6.4.
This data can be found in the background narratives that I believe were distributed to your committee, and it's on page 42.
I mean, if it does make you feel any better, Senator Olson, while American Indians were starting at 13.5, they've gotten to 9.9. I think the 13.2 was African Americans, and they've only gotten to 10.2, even though their target is 6.4. So,
Madam Chair, I realize that all of these rates, I'm sure, are unacceptable to all of us. I just happen to have a large percentage of American Indian people living in my district, and that's why I asked the question. And I would be very interested in the background information as to an analysis of the causes for why the infant mortality rate is so much higher among certain populations than others. That may be information this committee has already looked at in past years, but I would be very interested in that.
Sure. Well, you know, it is a combination of factors. Some of it has to do with the health care that is received during the prenatal months, but also nutrition is very important, and And in 2003, there were cuts to the WIC program. We were told at the time that there would be no WIC sites closed, but there were WIC sites closed in my district. I don't know how many other WIC districts had WIC sites closed, but so nutrition during pregnancy is a very important part of having a healthy baby that has a birth weight that would mean that it would not be susceptible to infant mortality.
Madam Chair, could I ask one more question?
Yes.
Could we see a breakdown of the causes for the infants who are dying among different populations to be able to evaluate if there are particular issues that are affecting certain populations more often in within certain cultural differences or racial differences than others?
The department said they is indicating they will get us that information.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pretner.
Madam Chair, on page 41 of the background material, it does provide some of the reasons for the disparities.
Are there other questions in this area? Okay, if not, then let's move on.
Madam Chair, we have two more items. One, I am going to lump together administrative support services and the executive office, and then we also had Scott Leitz is here to talk about our MERC grants and our MERC funding, if you want that.
So what order do you want to do that in?
I think I will just finish up with our detailed budget, and then we will move on to MERC.
All right.
On page 21 is our administrative support services, and this funding supports all of our internal functions around human resources, financial management, facilities management, our centralized IT services, and the executive office, the commissioner's office, and assistant commissioners and staff. It is primarily funded with through our federally approved indirect cost allocation, in which we charge federal grants and other non-general funded activities a portion of their budget to support the overhead costs of the department. The general fund, 29%, supports primarily the commissioner's office, the executive office of the department, and it supports the general fund's share of overhead, and we use those funding for agency rent to cover the lease rates that we pay to the Department of Administration for our building and to support the leases that we have for our district offices. We have 7 district offices around the state. There are no questions there. I think we will move on to MERC.
Are there any questions? All right, then let's move on.
We have a handout here.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Scott Leitz, and I'm an assistant commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health. I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the budget activities for the Medical Education and Research Cost, or MERC, grant program. The MERC fund was established in 1997, and the purpose of the program is to ensure the continuation of quality training of medical professionals throughout Minnesota. The training of medical professionals is a highly intensive process. Medical facilities which host trainees incur higher costs as a result of the training of these medical professionals, and traditionally, these providers charge somewhat higher rates to cover this additional cost of training. As our healthcare system has become increasingly focused on efficiency and cost containment, this has limited the ability of those training institutions to continue to cover the costs of hosting these trainees. In addition, Medicare, which has traditionally been a large funder of medical education, has scaled back its support for medical education activities at training institutions across the country over the course of the past 10 years. The Medical Education Fund was established to help ensure the availability of these training sites continued as financial pressures on them increased.
Funding through the MERC program is available for training sites which host medical students and residents, dental students and residents, pharmacy students and residents, advanced practice nurses, physician's assistants, and chiropractic students. Funding for the program, grant funding for the program is distributed based on a statutory formula. Dollars go to sponsoring institutions, which then pass funds on to the sites that actually train trainees for their programs. 90% of the funds in the grant program are distributed based on a formula which has two factors: an education factor, which measures the number of trainees and the relative cost of the trainees at a given site, and a public insurance factor, which measures the relative volume of Medicaid that's done at a given training site. In the formula, education is weighted at 2/3, and the Medicaid volume factor is weighted at 1/3. This ensures that dollars follow students to where they're being trained, but also recognizes those providers which have relatively high volumes of public program business in the Medicaid or Minnesota Care programs. 10% of the funds are distributed to sponsoring institutions for allocation to sites based on the priorities established by that sponsoring institution. Over the course of the program, the MERC program has distributed approximately over $300 million to training sites across Minnesota, and the last distribution that we had was approximately $60 million. If you go to the handout that was just provided, I can talk a little bit about what the sources of funding are for MERC and where the dollars flow. On the front side where it says MERC resources fiscal years 2006 and 2007 by revenue source shows the various revenue sources for the MERC program, and I'll briefly walk through each of those. The first one is dedicated cigarette tax revenues of $8.4 million. MERC has a dedicated portion of the cigarette tax in Minnesota as funding. An additional $4.9 million, the next line down, comes from a portion of the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center's dedicated cigarette tax revenues, which are transferred to the department for distribution through the MERC program. Combining the first line and the second line, we receive Medicaid matching funds on the cigarette tax revenues, amounting to $13.3 million. In addition, there's a $37 million, which comes from what's called the PMAP carve-out. The PMAP program is the managed care program for Medicaid recipients in Minnesota. The way that rates were traditionally built in the prior to managed care is there was a portion of the Medicaid rate which was paid to hospitals, which was intended to cover the cost of medical education. When we rolled those rates up into capitation rates to be paid to the health plans, that money was included in that capitation rate. And what the PMAP carve out does is it explicitly takes the money that's in the capitation rates paid to health plans, which is intended for medical education, carves that money out of that rate, and we pay it directly to hospitals through the MERC program. In addition, there's an additional $2.2 million of healthcare access funds that the University of Minnesota Academic Health Center has, which is transferred to the MERC fund, which is passed through funding, and I'll explain that in a moment that we pay back some of these funds to the University of Minnesota. We do receive federal matching funds on that healthcare access fund appropriation. And then finally, there's $17.4 million of Academic Health Center general funds, which also serve as a pass-through. So there's a total resource of $85 million, which goes into the MERC program. Now, the money that is transferred from the Academic Health Center, the dedicated cigarette tax money, the healthcare access fund money, and general fund money, we receive federal matching funds on those dollars, and then the original component upon which we receive federal matching funds is repaid to the University of Minnesota, and the matching funds are distributed either to the general fund or to the MERC program. So the amount that goes out in the MERC program is approximately $60.9 million.
And Mr. Leitz, the cigarette revenues must be reported to the federal government as a Medicaid expenditure in order to get a Medicaid match on it.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
So I think that's important notation to make, that these are not just, they cannot be used just in any old way, because they, in order to draw the federal money, they have a category that's been given to them.
Madam Chair, on the other side of the handout are the is a breakdown of there are hundreds of sites which actually receive MERC grants throughout Minnesota. We've just listed the largest of those sites, the top 20, as a breakdown for the committee. I'm not going to walk through those sites, but the top several are Hennepin County Medical Center, the University of Minnesota's Fairview campus, St. Mary's mm-hmm. Hospital and Mayo Clinic, and Regents Hospital, and so on, are the major, sort of thinking of the major recipients of those funds.
And I just might also, for the committee's education, let you know that there was at one time state general fund dollars that were in the MERC program that were not connected to Medicaid, and those were eliminated as a part of the 2003 budget cuts. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair, rookie question, if you don't mind. MERC stands for medical education, I'm assuming, or can you tell us, please?
Madam Chair, Senator, MERC stands for, and I apologize for using the shorthand, it stands for medical education and research costs. It was sort of the shorthand for the issues that were considered to be at risk in a cost-contained environment, the training of medical professionals and research at major institutions.
Thank you. And it really doesn't. I mean, somehow, originally, it was envisioned as an education and research fund, but the research funding part of it never happened. But it is an acknowledgement that there are some institutions that have higher costs because they provide medical education and research capacities that are enjoyed by the whole state. So we never felt like changing it to MEC, so we left it in MEC.
Madam Chair, one upcoming issue that I just want to make the committee aware of, it's a federal issue. The way that, just to remind the committee, the way that we distribute the funds, the cigarette tax funds in particular, is that the formula which distributes those dollars is based two-thirds on the education volume that a given site has and one-third on the amount of public program volume that they have. And those one-third and two-third are relative to other sites. So how much do they have relative to other sites? The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, which is the federal agency which administers the Medicare and Medicaid program, has been placing increasing scrutiny on state Medicaid programs around how they use dollars that are matched. Not so much in Minnesota, but concerns nationally about how things such as intergovernmental transfer dollars are used. And in particular, CMS has indicated to the state of Minnesota, to us, that funds which we receive federal matching funds for, so those dollars that are appropriated through the cigarette tax, for example, that we match under the Medicaid program, and those both the base and the matched funds are then distributed through the MERC program, need to have a closer tie to Medicaid volume than under MERC currently. Remember, it's two-thirds education volume, one-third Medicaid volume. Most likely, in order to receive matching funds on those dollars into the future, there may be a requirement placed by the federal government that we distribute those dollars closer to 100% based on Medicaid volume. So that would have a change in some of the who receives some of the funds, because some institutions do larger amounts of Medicaid volume than other institutions. So I just wanted to make you aware of that particular issue, and we'll likely need to have some language to address that issue if we want to receive legislative fund, or federal funds into the future.
Any questions? Senator Olson.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair. Again, this is a very basic question, but just to try to understand what you're talking about in the program, is what you're saying that part of the federal money that is being paid for patient care is being used to educate doctors so that they're available to provide that care in the future, as opposed to going directly into direct services for patients?
Mr. Leitz.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, all the dollars that flow through the MERC program do go to sites which serve Medicaid patients. So in a sense, the dollars are used as reimbursement to those sites for the care that they're providing to Medicaid patients. But the way that the dollars flow to those sites to provide that care is based on a somewhat a formula which also recognizes currently the amount of education that they do in addition to the amount of care that's actually provided to Medicaid recipients. So the dollars do go to the sites that provide the care as reimbursement for the care that they're being that's being provided to Medicaid recipients, just as it would for a direct billing situation. But in the case of Merck, the dollars are weighted right now so that they also recognize the amount of the number of trainees that are at that site.
The idea is that it costs more when you have training going on at your institution than if you didn't. And so this is to help offset that training cost. And it has been part of the Medicaid formula. This mechanism of carving it out made sure that the HMOs that we contract with were not distributing the money, but that the state was distributing the money based on whatever criteria we came up with. But it is part of the Medicaid program. Are there other questions? If not, any other general questions for the Department of Health?
Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to walk through our budget and let us know if you have other questions.
We will. Thank you very much, all of you, for your presentations both yesterday and today. And with that, then the meeting will be adjourned.
So they're only teaching institutions.